శ్యామంతి నామం. నమస్తే సరస్వతీదేవి గౌరవాణి ప్రచారణ విశేష శ్యామవరం పాశ్చాత్యాదిశితాన్నే. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. So today we're looking at the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text 10. The previous verse, actually, 4.9, was one of the most quoted by Srila Prabhupada. Janma karma chane divyam niramya vedi tatvataha japradeham punar janma nahiti mameti sojana. That anyone who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving this body, take birth again, but attains to my eternal abode. This is the translation of the previous verse, and it is one of the most quoted. But I thought that this one today, largely because of Srila Prabhupada's comments in the purport, is one of the most important verses and purports in the Bhagavad Gita, as it is by Srila Prabhupada. So, without further ado, we can all chant together.
Vitaragabaya krodha mannaya manupashritaha bahavo jnana tapasa utamadhavam agataha.
So the translation: being freed from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me, and thus they all attained transcendental love for me. In the purport, as described above, it is very difficult for a person who is too materially affected to understand the personal nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Generally, people who are attached to the bodily conception of life are so absorbed in materialism that it is almost impossible for them to understand how the Supreme can be a person. Such materialists cannot even imagine that there is a transcendental body which is imperishable, full of knowledge, and eternally blissful. In a materialistic concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance, and completely miserable. Therefore, people in general keep this same bodily area in mind when they are informed of the personal form of the Lord. For such materialistic men, the form of the gigantic material manifestation is supreme. Consequently, they consider the Supreme to be impersonal. And because they are too materially absorbed, the conception of retaining the personality after liberation from matter frightens them. When they are informed that spiritual life is also individual and personal, they become afraid of becoming persons again, and so they naturally prefer a kind of merging into the impersonal void. Generally, they compare the living entities to the bubbles of the ocean which merge into the ocean. That is the highest perfection of spiritual existence attainable without individual personality. This is a kind of fearful stage of life, devoid of perfect knowledge of spiritual existence. Furthermore, there are many persons who cannot understand spiritual existence at all. Being embarrassed by so many theories and by contradictions of various types of philosophical speculation, they become disgusted or angry and foolishly conclude that there is no supreme cause and that everything is ultimately void. Such people are in a diseased condition of life. Some people are too material attached and therefore do not give attention to spiritual life. Some of them want to merge into the supreme spiritual cause, and some of them disbelieve in everything being angry at all sorts of spiritual speculation out of hopelessness. This last class of men takes shelter of some kind of intoxication, and their affective hallucinations are sometimes accepted as spiritual vision. One has to get rid of all three stages of material consciousness. First, attachment to material life. Second, fear of a spiritual identity. And third, the conception of void that arises from frustration in life. To get free from these three stages of the material concept of life, one has to take complete shelter of the Lord, guided by the bona fide spiritual master, and follow the disciplines and regulative principles of devotional life. The last stage of the devotional life is called bhava, or transcendental love of Godhead. There's a very explicit description of the material energy and its effect on people's ideas about God consciousness. And one can see that Srila Prabhupada's analysis of this is for such a short paragraph. Well, it's actually a long paragraph, but for such a paragraph, it's very precise and very conclusive and very direct. He's not mincing words, and one can see in the various popular, one might say, the popular atheistic concepts that are very prominent now and very much a part of the or it might say the material conversation at the moment, they're very apt. But the most important, to my mind, section of this purport is the next part, where Srila Prabhupada quotes the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And it begins, Adau Shraddha Tata Sadhu Sangota Bhajana Kriya Tato Nartani Vritti Shyat Tato Nishta Ruchis Tataha Ta Saktis Tato Bhavas Tata Prem Abhyudanchati Sadakanam Ayam Prema Pradur Bhave Bhavet Kramaha. So, Srila Prabhupada gives a very broad translation of this verse. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. By execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadiness in self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. End of the translation. In the prema stage, there is constant engagement in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. So, by the slow process of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one can attain the highest stage, being free from all material attachment, from the fearfulness of one's individual spiritual personality, and from the frustrations that result in void philosophy. Then one can ultimately attain to the abode of the Supreme Lord. Om Gyan Timirandhasya Gyanan Jnana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this hierarchy, this stage of development of Krishna consciousness that Srila Prabhupada outlines here through the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu verse, is very instructive, because at the beginning one has Adau Shraddha. Shraddha, normally we translate that as faith, that one has faith. But actually here, Srila Prabhupada explains it as a preliminary desire for self-realization. So that preliminary desire, that faith, leads one to the association of others who are engaged or are on the spiritual path or trying to become spiritually self-realized. So what is interesting is that although these are the first two stages of Krishna consciousness, there are two stages that are never relinquished in Krishna consciousness. Oh, well, now I have faith, now I don't bother with faith anymore, or now I've had the association of devotees, now I will engage in the kriya, the practice of Krishna consciousness. I don't have to bother with associating with devotees anymore because I'm already there, and so on and so forth. Now, these qualities are there right from the beginning of the process, right to the end of the prema, of actual love of Godhead. One is always has this faith, just as all of Krishna's devotees always have this faith, and they're always associating with other devotees, and it is their life's goal, their life's fulfillment to associate with these other devotees of Krishna, because from that one derives the greatest benefit. And there's this word in the verse here, mabhavam agataha. So that gata, that word, we sing every morning in the Gaurastakam prayer, yasya prasada, bhagavat prasada, yasya prasada nagati kutopi, that gata, nagati kutopi. That without the mercy, from the mercy of the spiritual master, one gets the mercy of Krishna, and without the mercy, aprasada, of the spiritual master, one cannot make any advancement, nagati kutopi. So these are key understandings, and so the next stage of Krishna consciousness, this following the rules and regulations under the direction of a spiritual master. This is the next stage. And what that stage leads to, as we know from this, is anartha nivritti. Anartha means unwanted things. And so nivritti, rejecting unwanted things. And these unwanted things fall away very naturally in Krishna consciousness, just like before becoming involved in Krishna consciousness, one was engaged in so many things, inappropriate activities, actually self-harming activities, intoxication and meat eating and these kinds of things. And so these adverse effects, these adverse habits fall away naturally when one is in association. I remember this one person, by his great good fortune, when Srila Prabhupada came to South Africa, he was a very successful man. He was in his 40s, and he had made his fortune in gold speculation. So, and he was very proud of his liquor collection and all these things. And when he came to the programs that Srila Prabhupada held at the university in South Africa. And he also came to the temple, and he started, so his path of self-realization began at that point by this meeting with Srila Prabhupada. And his family would come on Sundays and help to prepare the Sunday feast. And so it was a very natural, and he said it was actually quite an achievement for him to pour his liquor collection down the drain. So this is the effect, the anartha nivritti, that one gives up unwanted things. And from this giving up of unwanted things, one becomes steady in Krishna consciousness. So this steadiness we see, that every morning we chant rounds, every morning we listen to the class at the temple, and in the day, we engage in Krishna's service in as much as we can. It becomes really our desire to simply be engaged in this way. And this is leads towards, this steadiness leads towards the taste, that after a while one develops the taste. So just as in the beginning of the process of devotional service, the practice of sadhana bhakti, there are certain things one doesn't like and certain things one likes, and taking prasadam one likes, and chanting the rounds not so much, and then and kirtan, you know, one likes, and maybe other things one doesn't like so much, having to do with one's service. And the association of devotees, sometimes it's up and sometimes it's down. And so then in the interpersonal relationships that one has, there's a natural flow of events. And of course, this is dealt with in the, very soon in the second chapter, and right at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, that one encounters, like the summer and winter seasons, one encounters heat and cold, and one rejects these. One does not reject them, but one learns to accept them as just passing, fleeting moments in time that one will learn to tolerate without becoming disturbed. So this is actually a very lofty goal, we can see. And looking at this, so verse and the purport, one sees that coming to the transcendental stage of loving Krishna, when one is so self-absorbed in one's own situation, one finds it hard to actually come to the idea that Krishna is actually there. He's really there. And he's really interested in what we're doing. It's hard to really internalize the fact that Krishna is independently interested in each and every one of us. He's independently interested in the ants. He's independently interested in each and every ant, in each and every insect, in each and every animal, in each and every plant. And he has somehow that, he has that ability to see and feel and empathize. It's a great quality that sometimes we hear about, that one has to have empathy and actually feel what the other person is feeling, and be able to accept their suffering as one's own suffering. And it's just in this way that great devotees, they take on the suffering of others. The great devotees that pray to Lord Chaitanya, for example, that let me take on the karma, let me take on the suffering of all the living entities so that they may go back home, back to Godhead. That's what the great devotees, of course, we're hardly in that category, and even the thought of that is kind of, in a way, very frightening. You know, you have to take on millions and millions of lifetimes, millions and millions of births, and millions of, so that others may be liberated. That's a very high realization. Anyway, coming back to our own situation, it's been made very easy for us by Srila Prabhupada. I was looking at the movie yesterday. I went to see the film, and it was so clear that Srila Prabhupada really operated on a very basic spiritual level, that his spiritual level is the spiritual level was the basis of everything that he was doing. He wasn't concerned with the temporary material arrangements, only in a very practical way as to how they would facilitate people's understanding of Krishna consciousness. Just like understanding, if one looks at the eight purposes of ISKCON that Srila Prabhupada outlined in his first registration of the ISKCON Society in 1966. And these are very amazing, very broad and elevated ideas, the re-spiritualization of the world through Krishna consciousness. That's an idea that is very lofty. And when one tries to think, how is it that now washing the pots and sweeping the temple and floor is going to become the re-spiritualization of the planet, of this universe? You know, it's kind of breathtaking in a way. You know, that that actually each and every one of us has a goal, and that goal, that seemingly material goal that the pots should be clean, is going to, you know, create this incredible renaissance in human spirituality. It's hard to compute. But I always think, when I ponder that realization of the verse in Bhagavad Gita 4:34, it's a famous verse that one should take shelter of a spiritual master, one should inquire from him, and one should serve him, and these self-realized souls can impart knowledge unto you because they've seen the truth. And so it doesn't seem like, of course, when asking questions is one thing, understanding the answers may be something else, but that the real purport of that is that service to the spiritual master and service to the devotees is actually what will fuel our understanding of Krishna consciousness, what actually brings us to these higher understandings. And that also does not seem to logically follow necessarily. I ask a question in class that I may think is pertinent, and it may not be. And there's kind of nice stories about devotees that would always want to ask Srila Prabhupada a question, but they never knew what to ask. You know? And I always found myself in that situation thinking about, gee, if I was in a morning walk with Prabhupada, what would I ask him? You know? And then it would come, well, I really don't have anything to ask him. I really do accept what he's saying, and I really accept that this process that he's presented to us is really perfect in its way, in its own way, in and of itself. It has an authenticity. It has a reality. And that reality is what we have to keep always rejuvenating within ourselves as to our situation and how we are going to become in the final essence of the Bhagavad Gita, how we are to achieve perfection. I mean, Arjuna was already kind of already perfect person, you know. He was a pure devotee, and he was, but he was subject, as we all are, to doubt. And because of that doubt, that he lost that faith, that immediate internal faith. And that faith had to be rejuvenated by Krishna. And so, in that way, we see that this is the same for us. We go through so many things in life where suddenly we become distracted from the goal. And we don't really feel that it's important. But it is. But it is important to come back always to this understanding, to this faith, and to the association of devotees, and to this understanding that by service to Srila Prabhupada and by service to the devotees, actually we are on the path. And however real or however humble the various aspects of our service or our situation may be, Krishna is not very concerned with that, and Srila Prabhupada is not very concerned with that. Just like this morning, there was the story of Srila Prabhupada's pastime, where he was in a meeting with some very big industrialists in India, and these were very millionaire, billionaire class of people, and one servant from very low class, obviously, person came in, and he came into this meeting and we placed something at Prabhupada's desk, I guess, at Prabhupada's feet, flowers. There were flowers that he placed there, and then he walked out. And Srila Prabhupada was very moved, and he didn't say anything for some time. But then he said afterwards, yes, like in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta prayachati. That if one offers me with love and devotion, a fruit, a flower, some water, I will accept it. So we should always be conscious of that, that Krishna will always accept, no matter how humble our service is. And so we're very encouraged by that, that relationship with Krishna should come in such insignificant ways, really. But they are significant for Krishna. They are significant for Srila Prabhupada. So that's a great encouragement for us. So, of course, I had a whole other lecture prepared. But anyway, I will try to get back to some of that. And we're trying to create a magazine that will appeal to people who have no idea of Krishna consciousness and have not really, but who are at least somewhat spiritual, who at least considering things, there's a trend today that people say that I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, or at least they want to be spiritual, but they don't want to be religious. And so how will this kind of person really understand Krishna consciousness? How can we bring something to a person who is in that mindset? Because actually they've done surveys, censuses, and now people are asked to give, what is your religion, you're Catholic, Jewish, Protestant, etc. And now the majority, in the largest percentage in the United States, the religious affiliation, they say none. So there was one joke that I want to become a nun, they say. So for this kind of person, the kind of approach that we take may be a little bit more circumspect. So for example, there's one example that we give here in this magazine. We call it the ecology of the soul, right? So ecology is a very trendy word these days. And so they did an experiment in the Yellowstone National Park where they reintroduced wolves into the park. And at the beginning, a lot of people were against that, especially the farmers, because it was under the auspices of the farmers that the wolves had been eradicated from the park, because the wolves would go onto the farms and attack the livestock on the farms. Anyway, somehow the ecologists managed to reintroduce wolves. And what happened was actually very surprising. After some years, they found that this introduction of the wolves, because the wolves were now the kings of the park in terms of the hierarchy of animals in the park, they were the biggest predator. So what happened was that previously the deer had been the top animal in the park. And so the deer were free to roam, and they had really decimated all the meadows in the park. So there was very little ground cover left, and the park was beginning to erode, and natural soil erosion was taking place, and so on. So with the introduction of the wolves, what happened was that the deer had to take shelter in the forests. They could no longer roam in the meadows freely, because they were always scared that the wolves would be there and would catch them. So what happened was the meadows started to grow again. And when the meadows started to grow, all kinds of other animals started to take shelter, the smaller animals like the rabbits and things like that. And it increased so much that actually the whole park was transformed. And it did take some years. And even because of the beavers and the rivers and that kind of thing, even the rivers started to flow in proper courses more properly. And so this was an unintended consequence of this happening. And this is, was outlined in a TED talk. And there are a couple of other experiments that have done. There was one with the growing trees in South America. In what used to be the rainforest had been decimated. And so these people, they had this land, they had this property, they started growing trees again. And the whole forest sort of gradually bloomed from just growing trees again. And so these examples, what they show is that when you introduce something into the upper realm of an hierarchy like that, then everything starts to change. So our process, our proposal to the people is that if you introduce this chanting of Hare Krishna, you introduce this reading of this literature and the association of devotees, a similar thing will happen in your consciousness. If you start a vegetarian diet, you start these things, and automatically your health will get better, your ability to think will become clear. All these things will start to happen as a byproduct of the natural introduction of something in the higher reaches of your consciousness. So this is one of the articles that we're presenting in this magazine. Of course, there are other the more usual Krishna conscious, I would say, articles, like, for example, the reincarnation thing. It's a very interesting thing, topic, reincarnation, because everybody kind of is interested in it, because it's kind of very spooky, and you have all kinds of stories of ghosts and ghostbusters, and these kinds of things are very popular in the consciousness, in the material consciousness, because they have no other, and they're very scary also. That's the other thing that was mentioned in this purport, that people have a fear of this kind of consciousness, because there's just so much unknown. And there's one interesting factoid, you might say. There was a professor at the University of Virginia, which was also in the news lately, but for other reasons. And this professor, he managed to introduce a section that would, in the university, a faculty, a department in the university, that would investigate accounts of past life experiences. So they would go and interview people who remembered their past lives, and some of them were very in all countries, but especially in India, and this was related also to near-death experiences. And so this professor, his name was Stevenson, Professor Stevenson, at the University of Virginia. There was one peer of his, another professor, who said to him, "Either you are perpetrating the biggest hoax on academia in the 20th century, or you will be recognized later on as the Galileo of the 20th century." Now, the relationship is because Galileo was one of the first to, in a sense, fight against the Catholic Church. I think the Catholic Church apologized to him about 20 or 30 years ago. It only took them about 500 years. But in any event, he actually discovered the movements of the planets, that the sun is the center of our solar system, and the Earth revolves around the sun, and previously they thought everything revolved around the Earth. So this was the relationship that this Professor Stevenson, in a way, is presenting, because it introduces completely a different spiritual view of the world, of science, and one that cannot be ignored, because it is provable in that sense. So therefore, that was one of the articles within the magazine deals with reincarnation based on these different articles, and then there's also on near-death experiences. Near-death experiences, there are two kinds. There are some where people, they see the body outside of themselves. In other words, they're undergoing some operation, and the ethereal body leaves the body, and they can see themselves on the operating table, and the doctors are working on them, and they hear, and they actually can relate afterwards what they saw during the operation, that kind of thing. And then there are other people who have near-death experiences where they go to the white light, or they go to some kind of heavenly situation. But what was very amusing was that there was one kind of experience, and this related to people in India, that they would have this experience, that they would be taken from the body by very horrible people, by very gross-looking individuals, and they would be taken to this court, and then Yamaraj would say to them, "You brought the wrong person, you have to take him back, it's not his time." These are actual accounts of the near-death experience that people in India have, because that cultural phenomenon, that cultural description within the scriptures is so common. Everyone accepts that there is Yamaraj. Everyone accepts those things. And so this was relatively speaking, a common near-death experience by people living in India, which the materialists will say, well, it is some kind of hallucination, and therefore, because the Indian people are having Indian hallucinations, and the Western people will have Western hallucinations in that way. So this is the materialistic argument against such phenomena. But they are there. These phenomena, that it seems to be clear that even the doubters agree that these phenomena exist. It's simply the cause that bothers them. And so then, of course, we have one section, a story section, and so maybe it's the story of King Yudhishthira at the lake, where he is being questioned by the lake, by the deity in charge of the lake, and he's asking so many questions, and he says, "If you can answer the questions, then you may drink." And so I wanted to just run some of the questions by you and see who knows the answers. All right, so the first question, what is quicker than the wind? The mind, yes. Now we all knew that one. And what is more numerous than the blades of grass in the field? You studied this one for the play, so... You're exempt from this question.
Is this a desire?
Is this a what?
The desires.
The desires.
That people have.
Not the desires. The thoughts, yes. Those are more numerous than the blades of grass. And what is it that when it is lost causes no regret? And who appears to be alive but is among the walking dead? Materialist is almost there. Miser. And what is heavier than the mountains? This one is tough. No. The love of one's mother and the words of one's father are heavier than the mountains. Ah, here's one. What is the best gift bestowed upon a man? That's too spiritual. Yes, that is correct. A wife who is both a friend and companion. Yeah. And what is another friend? Is a peaceful mind. And another companion is wisdom. And how is wisdom to be acquired? Service to the wise. Yes. Serving the wise brings us wisdom. What must we renounce to make us wealthy? Pride? No, it's more basic than that. Our desire for riches, fame, and adoration. And what is wealth? What is wealth? Yes, Krishna consciousness. But in a more pedestrian way, to look equally upon happiness or distress, upon a pebble or a piece of gold. And what is the greatest possession? Krishna prema, yes. Knowledge. Knowledge is the greatest possession. And what is our foremost duty in life? To seek the welfare of all living beings. And what is the best kind of happiness? Yeah. Is the happiness from within. It's one for the Buddhists there, you know. And finally, what is the most astonishing thing in the world? Yeah, that we all know. The most astonishing thing in the world is that people are dying all around us, our relatives, our friends, everyone, and yet we feel that we will not die. So, and then we have another article in this magazine, and we've called it The Guru Question. So the Guru Question was actually asked by John Lennon of the Beatles, and he asked, how do we tell who is a true spiritual master? And Srila Prabhupada's answer, well, you might think, would involve all knowledge of the absolute truth or Krishna conscious or something like that, but Srila Prabhupada's answer was very different in that he said, basically one has to belong to the parampara. One has to have surrendered to his guru has to surrender to his guru in a chain of disciplic succession, and that is a true guru. So, one thing that we explain in the article, I'll just read it because it's quite good. The guru doesn't just look holy while speaking some concocted feel-good philosophy, but he must be committed to the cause with body, mind, and soul. It's not ethereal or theoretical. The ancient spiritual authority, Prahlad, explains the 9 spiritual exercises. Hearing, chanting, and remembering the name, form, qualities, paraphernalia, and activities of the Supreme. Worship, prayer, serving the lotus feet of the Lord. Now, I always wondered, what exactly is this serving the lotus feet of the Lord? I mean, it's kind of, you know, where's the foot? And, you know, I can see it sort of with deity worship, serving the lotus feet. But it's really quite abstract if you think of it where, serving the lotus feet of the Lord. And then I did hit upon this explanation. Serving the lotus feet of the Lord by living a devoted life in a temple or a holy site. So living in an ashram, living in the holy dharam, this is a way of serving the lotus feet of the Lord. I had not really happened upon that explanation before starting on this article. Considering the Lord one's best friend, offering everything to the Lord. Persons who have dedicated their lives through these 9 methods should be understood to be the most learned persons, for they have acquired complete knowledge. And so the Srimad Bhagavatam is this guide for us. And a genuine guru acts in these ways and teaches the same to his followers. So that is, we're reaching the end. If anyone has some questions or comments, do we have the mic? Yes, ma'am.
What was the, I noticed in the purport of Srila Prabhupada's purport there, that a darshadha begins with shraddha, then associating with the devotees.
Yeah.
I'm aware that a lot of devotees who were born in this movement have not yet taken an initiation, even yet they are, have, I believe, some, a lot of faith, more than a great deal of faith, and they've been associating. How long should one wait, and what should one wait for, and how important is it to actually, at some point, take initiation? So three things. How important is it to actually take a diksha initiation? How long should one wait to do so, and what should one be wait for?
Thank you. That is a very, very good question, or a series of questions, I should say. Everyone has their own path. Srila Prabhupada himself, when he first met his spiritual master in 1922, he said, I accepted him at that time. And yet he only took formal initiation in 1933, 11 or 12 years later. And he was very fixed. So one cannot say that there is a one-size-fits-all in these situations, but it is recommended that one take formal initiation at some point, even though one may have accepted within one's heart that spiritual master. So it's difficult for us who were here during the time of Srila Prabhupada to advise in this way that, I mean, in generally in ISKCON we say, well, it used to be it was 6 months, now I think it's a year, you know, then you get first initiation, and then, you know, let's say a year after that, then the second initiation, and so on. So this is, these are kind of the formal, you might say, understandings of the ISKCON process. This is what we would like to see happen. With those who are, who have been born in the movement, I think it's very similar. I know in a case with our family, my daughter has not yet taken formal initiation. However, she has accepted a spiritual master that she follows, and she helps with transcribing his classes and doing service in that way to the spiritual master. And I'm very convinced that she will take a formal initiation at what to her will be an appropriate time. So there are different ways of saying it. I can't begin to judge her path in life. I can encourage, and I'm very happy that she has accepted an ISKCON guru as her guide and mentor in this life. And as I say, it's simply a question of time before the process is fully implemented, before that formality is fully implemented. So that's what you have another? Yes.
Some of these devotees, they accept the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, and their following is very serious, and they have full faith in Srila Prabhupada. But they are not like your daughter in the sense that they have yet attached themselves to any particular initiating spiritual master like she has. So what about them?
Well, they are, it depends on how much they are in association with devotees. By and large, we find that my son, for example, he's in a different category. He was always a rebel, and that is his mode of understanding. However, he has remained vegetarian, and he does attend Ratha Yatra, and he he has association with friends who, like himself, grew up, a lot of association with the friends that he grew up with who are in a similar situation. They're not full-time devotees, but they have their families, and they have their social situation that is going on, and they have their means of livelihood. And also, so in such an instance where they're not in a nickel, and I know that he does take shelter of Lord Mishinadev when things get tough. You know? So in that way, I think he's very much a devotee. But due to life's circumstances, gurus that fell away, that kind of thing, it's hard for him now to accept in that way. So these individual situations are there. Thank you, Guru. Very good questions, thank you. Yes, Guru.
I was adding to you gave a very nice explanation also. But I was reflecting Mahasuya Maharaj. When he joined, he was smoking under a tree, and the president says, Prabhupada is giving initiation. Would you like to take initiation? So he got initiated, and then he said, don't smoke anymore from today. So he was smoking this morning, but then he got initiated. It was interesting at the end, and he had a little discussion with Prabhupada, and so I was taking from that angle that senior devotees in our movement also has to create an impression to the young generation that self-realization, like Prabhupada, the way Prabhupada translated, I thought is, as you mentioned, the preliminary desire to have self-realization. So that has to be created by senior devotees. Not necessarily the second generation will come on their own. It has to be created by our influence. We have to give association to them so that they will feel that it is necessary in them, and then they will automatically be attracted. We can't think like that it will happen automatically.
No, these things are not automatic. Where there is a very natural desire, that is the symptom of the spirit soul, that one always has some desire. And that desire for self-realization, has to become prominent. That's really.
And so another point you mentioned that even Prabhupada did not want to see his Guru Maharaj. He says, I did not want to see. But he forced me, he dragged me
to see.
Yes. So when the Guru Kulis or the second generation don't want to take initiation, I think like Prabhupada also didn't want to. But then when somehow they came in association with a great personality and then got defeated with his preconception of Gandhi's movement and other, and then he was very attracted. So this way also we see it's changing among the second generation.
So one devotee there has a question. Thank you, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. To add to your definition of Prabhupada's quote on the definition of a guru, bona fide guru, you also said, I believe, that the bona fide guru is the one who can deliver the devotee from the cycle of birth and death, and by extrapolation, from the fear of death, and from further extrapolation, from the maya of this material world.
Yeah.
I'm doing extrapolating. The question then comes, it was so wonderful to see the Prabhupada on the big screen.
Yes.
Bigger than life, because he was bigger than life, obviously. And the question comes, why are so many of the interviewees entrepreneurs, because to me, my experience in the entrepreneurial world is one of going for the fruits of the material world. So that's my question. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. That's a tough question. How is it that they became entrepreneurs after being devotees, after being so intimately associated, one might say, with Srila Prabhupada and with the ISKCON movement? And what one can say is that one cannot deny one's natural inclinations. The term is svabhava, that just as Arjuna had a certain svabhava, he had a certain a mode of being within the world, born into a Kshatriya family, and most of these devotees who became later on entrepreneurs were born in similar kinds of families, you could say. And the unfortunate thing is that they could not hold on to their faith and felt that they had to leave Krishna consciousness for whatever reason, and there were many reasons. I'm sure in each case there were many reasons why they left. But the basic, it's hard when I go in my mind, you know, I picture the different devotees that you're referring to, you know, it just seems that from the original, what we once termed the Magnificent 11, not many came through that gauntlet. They were presented with every opportunity to become Krishna conscious and to fulfill the role of Krishna consciousness as leaders of the movement, and yet they weren't able to. By whatever arrangement of Krishna and by whatever desires they may have had, and by whatever offenses they may have committed, because one does see that committing offenses is one of the great reasons. And when one is in a situation of control and management of devotees, the opportunities for making offenses is rather great. And one never knows how one may take it, just as here's the story, Jiva Goswami, so he's meditating on Radha and Krishna, and all of a sudden, and he laughed, there was some joke was going on, Rupa Goswami. So some joke was going on with Radha and Krishna, and he laughed. And just at that moment, it happened that there was a very nice devotee visiting, and when he came in, Rupa Goswami laughed. And so he took offense. Oh, he's laughing at me. Why is he laughing at me? So he took offense at that. And immediately, Rupa Goswami's meditation stopped immediately. And he could no longer enter into that pastime. And he could understand, oh, I must have committed some offense, because otherwise, you know, this would not have happened. And so that's how the story. So one can see that actually, this committing of offenses, if one is in a position of authority, it's just like in the feudal times, or you might say Vedic times, when a king has responsibilities, and he has to make judgments. He has to be judge and jury in certain legal cases. He may make mistakes, very grievous mistakes. People may pay with their lives for these mistakes. And in order to expiate those mistakes, it is his duty to perform sacrifices. And therefore, Vedic kings, they perform these big yagyas and these big sacrifices in order to become free from these offenses to their citizens. And that was the system. And the people accepted that system like that. And because it was understood that whenever a king would have to make a decision, some people would benefit and some people would lose. And therefore, to obviate those losses, the king would perform sacrifice. So that's the system as we understand it. And so we can apply that in some way or another to the situation within ISKCON of devotees who leave and so on. But anyway, this is getting into a territory where I don't think afterwards we can discuss. But thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.